Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. As the old saying goes, most people murder for love or money. Add revenge to that, and you've got the perfect evil trifecta. Today's episode represents all three. It's a story about brothers in a religious family, which immediately summons images of Cain and Abel, a favored son, a black sheep. You could also say the murderous brother broke a commandment, several in fact. Honor thy mother and father. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not murder. Except it wasn't his neighbor's wife, it was his brother's. And their steamy affair tore apart the family. And as the scandal grew, the patriarch of the clan, Philip Height, warned his son that if he didn't stop the affair, he would be disinherited. In the end, the father and the good brother were dead, the mother was disfigured, the black sheep was in jail, and the wife was banished. It was a shocking scandal. The Heights were pillars of the community in the small town of Springfield, Georgia. Popular, well-respected, godly, and charitable. Except for Craig Height, the self-professed black sheep of the family, who was in love with his brother's wife, Robin. And Robin was guilty of sharing her brother-in-law's feelings. But just how responsible she is for this almost biblical tragedy is up for you to decide. Welcome to Episode 51, A Family Affair, The Height Double Murder Scandal. Springfield is located in southeast Georgia in Effingham County. It's about 25 miles or about 40 kilometers northwest of downtown Savannah. Created February 5, 1777, Effingham was one of the original counties in the state of Georgia during the American Revolution, from the colonial parishes of St. Matthew and St. Philip. It is named for Lord Effingham, more properly known as Thomas Howard, the 3rd Earl of Effingham. Though he was an English lord, he was a champion of colonial rights, and he resigned his commission rather than fight against rebel colonists. The tiny city of Springfield is the heart of Effingham County and serves as the county seat. It is rich in regional history and very proud of its heritage. In 1907, the railroad came to town. Then in 1908, Springfield became home to the new county courthouse. The classical Greek-style courthouse commanded a square that served as the heart of the town, around which all communal activities were planned. Houses began popping up on the fringes of the square, growing outward from the courthouse, creating a square town plan. Springfield experienced its major residential growth around 1910. During that period, the architectural fashion in houses transitioned to the more elaborate and ornate Victorian style. Most historical homes in Springfield reflect this style, often called folk Victorian. The homes were also built with the Georgia coastal climate in mind. They were built on raised foundations to allow for floods as well as ventilation, with high ceilings and large beautiful windows strategically placed to provide a cross breeze. Exaggerated eaves and porches were designed to protect the interior from the blazing Georgia heat. Windows were designed so that the top sash could let out the hot air while the bottom sash was lowered to draw in cool air. Though Main Street no longer provides hitching posts for horses and carriages, it is still a main thoroughfare for foot traffic, where you can glimpse peaks of the historic mansions behind majestic, century-old oak trees. Now the streets that branch out from the square wind around family-friendly ballparks and playgrounds. Springfield residents take pride in the original courthouse and other historical structures that are still standing, despite a series of fires from the late 19th century to the 1960s. Springfield touts itself as a place where family, faith, and the neighborly spirit serve as cornerstones. The picturesque square and Main Street reflect the way of life in a town with a population of under 3,000. A town where everyone knows everyone. And a town where everyone knows each other's business. When Sheriff Jimmy McDuffie was called out in the pre-dawn hours of August 25, 2008, to a home on Springfield Egypt Road, The house number rang a bell for him. He was responding to an urgent call from his deputy, who had found two dead bodies and a grievously injured woman. And then he realized who it was. That's Philip's house, he thought. The sheriff and Philip Height had been buddies since McDuffie moved there in 1987. 59-year-old Philip Height was a successful real estate developer who had made millions in Effingham County over the years. He and his son Kerry were partners at Coldwell Banker Intercoastal Realty. Philip was a lifelong member of Bethel Lutheran Church, where he served on the church council. His family and faith were the most important things in his life. Philip was a native of Effingham County and was very proud of it. He was well respected there and in Springfield. He worked tirelessly for the growth, development, and prosperity of the county. He served on the board of directors of Citizens Bank of Effingham County as president of the Chamber of Commerce and was an advisory board member of the Coastal Georgia Rivers Water Planning and Policy Committee. Philip met his wife Linda at the county fair held in Savannah in 1967. It was love at first sight. That same year, he also joined the Georgia Air National Guard, where he served for 20 years before retiring as a technical sergeant in 1987, then turning his full focus to real estate and community advocacy. The Heights had their first child, Craig, the year they married in 1967. Middle child Chris came in 1970, and baby brother Kerry 6 years later. This put 9 years between Craig, the eldest, and Kerry, the youngest. Family members agree that Craig and Chris had more in common. Physically, they looked more alike, and they both enjoyed hunting and fishing. The youngest son, Kerry, was more gentle, but was also his father's son, quickly following in his footsteps into the family real estate business. And like his father, he was quickly successful, active in his church and community, and was well respected and liked in Springfield. Middle brother Chris Height had made his own success in the construction business and was also a popular Springfield citizen, father, Christian, and friend. Eldest brother Craig Height was the family's black sheep. Those are his words, not mine. He called himself that all the time. He had been married and divorced and rarely paid child support for his kids. His daddy paid the house payment where his ex-wife, son, and daughter lived. He was living temporarily in a friend's hunting cabin, cashing disability checks for a back injury from when he worked for Georgia Pacific Manufacturing. The youngest Height brother, Kerry, met Robin Rast in Springfield High School, and the two married not long after graduation. She was pretty, with raven dark hair. In 13 years of marriage, they had 3 children. Philip, 10 years old, Mackenzie, 7, and Elena, just 3. They lived in a nice house on a huge tract of land with horses. Robin said Kerry was a good provider, a good father, and a good husband. She said they had a good life. But the Great Recession of 2008 had evidently affected Kerry more than he let on at home. He worked in real estate, so the recession did hit his business hard. But his long hours at the office left Robin feeling lonely, and she complained that he didn't pay enough attention to her. Robin has admitted that in April of 2008, she initiated the affair with her brother-in-law. After a family dinner at a local restaurant, they went back to the Height family home. In a private moment, Robin told Craig she was attracted to him. He told her he felt the same. The first time they had sex was the very next day, in the living room of Philip and Linda's home, her husband's childhood home. Soon, a full-on torrid affair began. They mostly met at the cabin Craig was staying at, and while Robin admits she had feelings for Craig, she said it was just an infatuation and insisted she still loved her husband. Loved him so much that she told him about the affair just 2 weeks later. And he was devastated. But she said he was dead set against divorce and insisted they seek counseling, which Robin said they did try. And yet, she continued the affair. I'm going to pause now for a quick commercial break. On the 48 Hours episode on this case, Robin was asked why she even told Carrie if she was going to continue the affair. She said that Carrie knew something was wrong and that she wasn't acting like herself. She said, "I just couldn't hide it from him." Often, confessions about affairs are usually either when one needs to unburden their soul about a betrayal because they are in pain but still love their partner and need to be honest. While often considered selfish, it is still honesty. And many marriages can come through an affair with total honesty and a lot of therapy. The other reason a cheating spouse will confess is when they want out of the relationship. They've decided they want a divorce, and the quickest way to talk a spouse into divorce is to admit to an ongoing romantic relationship with someone else. But Robin continued the affair, and continued her marriage. She didn't seem to want to end either relationship. Watching her in interviews is odd. I'm not sure if it's enlightening or more confusing. She smiles coquettishly and inappropriately at sensitive questions. She doesn't really seem that sorry for hurting her husband, setting these awful events into motion. Quote, "I'm not proud of it, but it's a mistake anyone could make." I don't know about you, but cheating isn't just a mistake anyone can make, especially with your husband's brother. That was a willful choice, and she admittedly made the first move, and then refused to end the affair when the family found out. So why didn't she just leave? Wouldn't that have been better for everyone involved? I'm sure it's because the affair was not with an acquaintance or even a close friend. It was her husband's brother. I suppose she didn't see a real future with Craig, and yet she wouldn't give him up. But Carrie wasn't giving up either. She said he told her he wished it had been anyone else but his brother, but that they could work things out. He also said Craig would never be a part of his children's lives. By that summer, Craig and Carrie's parents knew, and Philip was outraged at Craig. Philip and Carrie confronted the lovers together, telling them to end the affair or there would be consequences. Philip told Craig if he didn't stop, he would write him out of his will. He told Robin she should remember the life that Carrie had given her, a cushy, expensive lifestyle that Craig would never be able to provide. Robin and Craig had initially denied the affair to Philip and Linda, insisting they were just friends. But now the family knew, and they weren't having it. Craig and Carrie got into several heated fights. Family friend Billy Hickman, who worked as a financial advisor for both Philip and Carrie, would later testify that he knew of the affair and how distressed his friend Philip was over it. He said that, quote, "He tried to get in the middle of it, like most parents would. He said they threatened to kill each other." Needless to say, things were going beyond the family pressuring Craig and Robin to end the affair. Robin didn't know it, but Carrie Height had hired a divorce attorney and changed the beneficiary on his $3.5 million life insurance policy. The money would now go into a trust for their three children. He also had a new will drawn up. Philip Height also changed his will. He first told his attorney to completely write Craig out of it, but then changed his mind and changed his share from a third to one-ninth. He signed this new will on August 22, 2008, just 3 days before the murders. Carrie was supposed to sign his new will that same day, but missed the appointment. But the insurance policy was in effect. Robin later testified that she had no idea Carrie had changed the life insurance policy, or that Philip had changed his will. Philip had threatened, but she didn't know it had already happened. On the Thursday before the murders, tensions reached a boiling point when Craig brought a gun to his father's house to confront his brother. He and Carrie wound up fighting, with Philip breaking it up. On the next evening, Friday, August 23rd, Robin was supposed to go to an adult slumber party for a teacher at an elementary school where she was an assistant. But one of the teachers got sick and they canceled the evening. Robin didn't tell Carrie her plans had changed. Instead, she met Craig at the cabin and spent the night with him. They talked that evening about all the drama, and Robin said they specifically talked about how Philip was trying to intervene, or meddling, as she put it, trying to control the situation. As family patriarch, he wasn't just concerned for his son Carrie, but also for the family's reputation. Craig expressed hatred for his father, telling Robin he wouldn't piss on his father if he was on fire, and that if Philip and Carrie weren't careful, he would go old school on them. Robin later claimed she didn't know what this meant, but thought he was just blowing off steam. The two woke the next morning to the sound of a helicopter. It was lingering over the top of the cabin. Carrie tried to blow it off at first, but Robin sensed they were being watched. She was right. The helicopter belonged to and was flown by a man named Ellis Wood, a business associate and good friend of Phillips. He had found them by tracking the GPS on Robin's car. Carrie Height had given him the coordinates. It would seem that Philip and Carrie Height were gathering evidence of the affair, probably to use in what promised to be an ugly divorce. Robin had spent Saturday night at a friend's house rather than going home to deal with Carrie. But she returned Sunday morning after church to cook lunch for Carrie and the kids. She said that she and Carrie got into a terrible fight, with Robin refusing to end the relationship with Craig. Carrie was angry and distraught. He left, telling her he was going to spend the night at his parents' house. In a move that would be heavily questioned later, Robin called Craig that evening and told him Carrie was spending the night at their parents' house. It was the first time he had done that in their 13-year marriage. She also confirmed to him that Carrie and Philip had sent the helicopter. Craig was incensed. But Robin swore later she had no idea what he would do next. Which, considering the heated fights, Philip's warnings to her and Craig's veiled threats would seem irresponsible at best, incendiary at worst. Maybe she was just warning him that they were collecting evidence of the affair. Maybe she didn't know what he planned to do. Maybe she was just a bitch who thrived on drama. But she had just set in motion a brutal act that would shatter the Height family. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsor. Everyone has a family member who tells the best stories. StoryWorth helps capture those memories, preserving them forever. How it works is you purchase a subscription for someone you love, and each week, StoryWorth sends them an email with a question about their life. Then they can just answer the email, or they can record their story over the phone by calling the StoryWorth number. And at the end of the year, all of these precious stories will be bound into a beautiful keepsake book. The weekly emails alone are a great way to stay connected with family that may be spread apart. Your loved ones can write those stories and also upload photos to go with them by email or on StoryWorth.com. They can save and edit everything on the website, knowing their data is secure in StoryWorth's hands. StoryWorth is a wonderful gift for Mother's Day. I can't wait to read some of the stories my mom sent in, like how she let me believe that I got my little sister for my birthday. To start your own family's book of beloved stories, go to StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. Southern Fried listeners will get $20 off their subscription by going to StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. Go ahead and sign up your family member for a truly unique and special gift that your whole family will treasure at StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. When Sheriff Jimmy McDuffie responded to his deputy's call around 3:30 a.m. on August 25th, he realized he was headed to the home of his friend, Philip Height. The deputy on scene had called the sheriff, backup, and an ambulance. The deputy had responded to an urgent 911 call. Linda Height placed the call at 3 a.m. "Help, help, help," she said, "and I'm shot. Hurry." But it took the operator 6 minutes to get the address from her. She was so hard to understand. Linda had been shot in the face, in the side of her jaw. But the 911 operator clearly heard her say she had been shot and jumped into action until she figured out the address. Linda also told the operator her husband had been shot. And when the operator asked who had shot them, she said she didn't know. Linda Height was a 58-year-old grandmother who was a night owl and loved word puzzles. She had been awake that horrible evening, up, enjoying one of her puzzles. She had gotten up to go to the bathroom when she heard the first blast. She didn't immediately think it was a gunshot. She was instead worried about her husband's CPAP machine. It is a respiratory apparatus to help with snoring and sleep apnea. She always worried a lightning strike would hit the machine, and that was her first thought. She stepped out of the bathroom just in time to see her husband blasted in the face with a shotgun. And as the gun swung around to her, she turned her head just in time, or she would have been dead too. She fell to the floor and blacked out. When she came to, she saw her teeth and blood on the floor. Her clothes felt wet, and she smelled gas. She later said that she wrote in her journal that she now knew what hell smelled like, gasoline and gunpowder. She staggered over to the landline phone in her bedroom, close to where her husband lay dead, but couldn't get a dial tone. The phone lines had been cut. Then she remembered her cell phone. It was in her purse in the kitchen. Somehow she made it there without passing out again and dialed 911. She sat against a wall, holding close to her bleeding neck and face, and waited for help. The first deputies on scene found Kerry Height in his old childhood bedroom, dead, shot through the face. Philip Height was also dead in his bed, though it looked like he had raised up, probably hearing the other shot. He was also shot through the face. Crime scene experts in the coroner would later agree that the shotgun blasts had been about 2 feet from each man's face. This was up close and personal. When Sheriff McDuffie arrived, he immediately called in the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Jimmy McDuffie knew that he was too close to the family to oversee the investigation. Agent Eugene Howard was first on the scene, and he immediately knew it didn't look like what it seemed. It was supposed to look like a robbery. Along with the cut phone lines, someone had smashed a pane of glass in the door. But nothing was taken. No jewelry, no electronics, nothing was rummaged through, and there was even money sitting out in the open. He told 48 Hours he knew that robbery wasn't the motive. Murder was the motive. The killer had spread gas all over the house, but had not lit a match. Investigators thought perhaps he heard Linda Height call 911 and panicked, running away instead. Word spread quickly through the small town, and most people feared a crazed killer was on the loose. Though some close friends knew about Craig and Robin's affair, it wasn't public knowledge yet. So the town believed maybe it was a nearby drug dealer. There was a man who sold meth down the road, but he was checked out and cleared immediately. The police naturally looked into Philip's real estate dealings, but there was nothing there. Philip Height was known as an honorable businessman with many friends and no enemies. No one could understand the motive, but Sheriff Jimmy McDuffie did remember a conversation he had had with Kerry Height about a month earlier. McDuffie later testified that Kerry, quote, knew that his wife was running around on him, but he did not tell me who it was with. When the police knocked on Robin's door at 5 a.m. to inform her of her husband's death, she said she went into shock. They asked her if she knew anyone who wanted to hurt her husband and his parents, and she said no, she couldn't think of anyone. She would later swear in court and in interviews that this was true. That she was so shaken up, her mind did not immediately think of Craig, the man she was having an affair with, the man who had been fighting with her husband and in-laws, the man who had made veiled threats just the day before. But she was suspicious enough to confront Craig on her own later that day. She said she asked him, "Did you do this?" And he said, "I can't believe you would ask me that." She said, "I need a yes or no." And he said, "No." She said she believed him because the Craig Height she knew couldn't commit such an act. But investigators were immediately suspicious. They were tipped off pretty quickly to who Robin was having an affair with. They had always thought the scene looked staged and that the crime seemed very personal. One odd clue at the crime scene was a key left in the deadbolt, but on the inside of the door. The same door that the pane of glass had been smashed through. The Heights kept a key for that deadbolt on their mantle, but it was still there. There was another spare key to that lock, one the whole family knew about. It was outside the garage, on top of the air conditioning unit. This was the key that was found in the inside lock. A picture was starting to form, an ugly picture, of the black sheep of the family, the eldest son who was sleeping with the youngest son's wife. They believe Craig broke the glass later to make it look like a burglary, but had actually used the spare key to enter the house. He walked straight to his brother's room and shot him in the face. He then walked into his parents' bedroom and, as his father rose in the bed, shot him in the face too. As his mother came out of the bathroom, seeing this through the gun smoke, he turned the shotgun and fired it at her face. He may have believed his mother was dead. She had fallen and passed out and was bleeding heavily. Investigators then believe he went and retrieved a gas can and spread it all over the house, even dousing his own mother, whose clothes were later found to be soaked in gas. He had put the spare key into the deadlock and locked it from the inside so the door would be locked when the police arrived, with the broken glass explaining the entry. But he forgot. He panicked and left the key in the deadbolt instead of putting it back on top of the air conditioner. Maybe he was about to strike that match when he heard his mother on the phone and realized it was too late. It was possible she would identify him. So he locked the door and ran, forgetting to return the key. Linda Height was taken to a hospital in Savannah and was put into an induced coma. Though she was improving, she was unable to speak. Effingham County Sheriff's investigator, Mason Galloway, was ordered to guard her room. He later testified that her surviving sons, Chris and Craig, came to see her separately. He said that when Chris was there, she tried to smile and seemed happy. But he noticed that Craig didn't show as much emotion, and when he held his mother's hand and told her he loved her, her eyes got really wide and the blood pressure machine showed that her pressure skyrocketed from 98 to 140, and that she started shaking. Linda Height later called this account of Craig's visit ridiculous. Despite the ugly drama in her family, she really didn't believe that Craig had done this. She had not seen anything but the gun that night, and she would stand by her son through his trial. In those first few days of investigation, Craig Height tried to appear helpful to law enforcement. He complied to a search of his cabin and truck and, without anyone asking him, pointed out that his shotgun was missing. He also mentioned that a pair of boots and a gas can were missing. A search of his truck found shells in the bed that matched the type of shotgun used. But without the gun or the spent shells, police could not run ballistics tests. Though he had made other sloppy mistakes at the scene, he did pick up the spent shells. Also, in those first few days, the sheriff had to release a statement to quell the fear of the community who thought that a murderous burglar was on the loose. Without naming suspects, he said that the Heights were the only targets in this crime and the community had no reason to worry. But as weeks turned into months without an arrest, the public found out about Robin and Craig's affair and demanded to know why he hadn't been arrested. One concerned citizen even called the GBI to demand his arrest. The problem was, there was no physical evidence tying Craig to the scene. It was all circumstantial. Yes, he had means and motive. No, he didn't have an alibi. But you get one shot at a murder trial, and they weren't risking Craig Height going free. One thing they did have, though, were bruises on Craig's right arm. A colleague of Agent Howard's had a hunch. He said shotguns fired in that close range often leave bruises, especially in a situation where the person holding the gun might be panicked. The gun could slip, bruising his arm. So Agent Howard asked Craig to show him his arm. Sure enough, there were bruises, right where the colleague said they would be. But Craig told an elaborate story of how he fell out of his shower and over the toilet. There is even video of him trying to demonstrate this. But the more likely cause was the kickback from the shotgun, just as investigators had guessed when they asked to see his arm. The bruises are a common sight to firearm experts, and though they were in the same general area, there were three distinct bruises. Nobody was buying his story, and every time he opened his mouth, he made it worse. During the investigation, he flat out denied the affair with Robin, something the police already knew about and she had already confessed to. He said, quote, "I know that it looks bad, but I'm going to tell you something. I couldn't do that to my brother." The bastard even said, quote, "I swear to you on my mama's life." As the police were doing the best they could with a circumstantial case, they came across a realtor that Craig Height had gone to see named Christy Campo just 2 weeks before the murders. He wanted to purchase some land. Campo was surprised Craig wasn't going through his father for the purchase, And he even told this woman, a virtual stranger, that he was the black sheep in the family and he wouldn't piss on his father if he was on fire. That's twice he used that phrase. Campo asked him how he planned to raise the money. The land he was interested in was $400,000. He told her he planned to sell off a tract of land elsewhere and also to pay off a home mortgage to get another loan. He said he would know for sure in a couple of weeks. It was almost 2 weeks to the day that he murdered his father and brother. And that other tract of land he mentioned had actually come up before when Philip Hite was changing his will. He had recently purchased that land with Craig in mind to build there, and now he wanted to make sure it wasn't part of Craig's inheritance. The inheritance that had been reduced from 1/3 to 1/9 of his total net worth, which was around $15 million. So Craig Hite had lots of motive. His love for Robin and jealousy of Carrie, his hatred of his father, and his desire for money. He probably knew that his father would make good on his threat to change his will and that he needed to act fast. By Christmas, before his arrest, Craig had moved in with Robin, drove Carrie's truck, and even took his kids to school. Carrie's children adored Uncle Craig, while his own kids wanted nothing to do with him. Finally, on May 22, 2009, almost 9 months after the murder, Craig was arrested. The police declined to say why they arrested him at this time, as they still had not found physical evidence, but I think they might have been concerned with him leaving the state. He and Robin had purchased wedding rings and planned to move to Charleston. Robin was born there, moving to Georgia when she was around 10. The two were planning on starting a new life. And not only were they living in Carrie Hite's home, they were living on Robin's inheritance from his will. While the life insurance had gone to the children, Carrie had never signed the new will. Robin was blowing through $350,000 she had inherited pretty quickly. So the police moved, and Carrie was indicted on 11 charges, among these, 2 counts of first-degree murder, assault and aggravated battery, and attempted murder for his mother, burglary, attempted arson, and 3 counts of possession of a firearm during a commission of a felony. His trial didn't take place until December of 2010. During that time, there had been more drama. On February 4th of 2010, Robin Hite was arrested and charged with threatening a witness. This was a felony. Though her arrest was public record, the police declined to say who exactly she threatened. She was released on bond and told to move to Charleston with her mother until the trial. Needless to say, within a few months, she turned on Craig Hite, and by the time he went to trial, she was one of the star witnesses, and the charges against her had been dropped. But first up, with heartbreaking testimony, was Linda Hite. She had recovered from her injuries, though permanently disfigured. She could speak clearly, however. Prosecutor Michael Muldrew had said in opening arguments that this crime was fueled by things as old as the Bible, lust and money. He had laid out the scandalous affair, the ensuing fights, the changing of Philip's will. Linda Hite testified to everything she remembered about that night, but insisted she did not see her son. She admitted under cross-examination what Craig had said during a fight with her husband that she had witnessed. Quote, he said if he wanted Robin, he'd have Robin. But then she even smiled at Craig as she left the witness stand. Incredibly, his other brother Chris also remained steadfastly at his side. He was in court every day, sitting beside his mother once she testified. They were the only people who still supported Craig, and they had every right to disown him. Even Craig's son Josh testified against him, telling the court how upset his grandfather had been and what a deadbeat his father was. Robin's testimony was probably the most damning. She tearfully admitted to the affair and even said that she initially believed Craig when he said he didn't do it. She just didn't believe he was capable of it. She testified about a meeting she had with Philip Hite, whom she referred to as Mr. Philip, at his office. She had gone to ask him to stay out of it. Philip told her that Craig was bipolar and wouldn't take medication. There is no proof that Craig suffered from this condition. Robin confirmed to the court that she never saw him take medication for it. Philip also told her she needed to reevaluate her life, that his son Craig was sleeping with 2 other women, which turned out to be true, and reiterated that he could never give her the life that Carrie had. She testified about the night before the murders at the cabin and the threats Craig had made about going old school on his father and brother, and of how angry he was when she called the next day and told him the helicopter was a friend of his father's spying on them. She even admitted to calling him on Sunday night to tell him about her fight with Carrie and that he would be sleeping at his parents' house. She essentially told him that his hated brother and father would be in the same house that evening. If she wasn't in on it, it seemed incredibly stupid to tell him this. And this was not lost on jurors. In later interviews, they wondered why she wasn't charged as an accessory. They felt she definitely had a hand in this. One juror said that, quote, "Robin Height was a manipulative person who stopped at nothing to get what she wanted. And considering she insisted on keeping up with the affair but wanted to stay married to her rich husband, I tend to agree. She wanted both. She wanted to have her cake and eat it too." Another juror remarked, "She played him like a fiddle." In the 48 Hours episode, the prosecutor was questioned about Robin's possible motive, and he said he could only go by the evidence. Quote, "Based upon her testimony that she gave against him, it did not appear at the time that she was participating in any plan." "And you believe her?" they asked him. He replied, "I didn't say that. I said we have to go by the evidence." Robin was asked on the stand why she changed her mind. After all, she had moved Craig into her husband's house. They had plans to marry. She had even paid $60,000 for his lawyer out of her inheritance from Carrie's will. Neither one worked. They were just living high on the hog until Craig was suddenly arrested that May. So what did change her mind? Robin testified she had questioned him about the murders months later, and Craig told her that he had made amends with his father and brother and that they had forgiven him. This is what she said convinced her he was lying. Because in that final fight with Carrie, before he went to his parents' house that fateful night, he told her how much he hated Craig for what he had done to his family. But I think she changed her mind once she was implicated for intimidating a witness. She saw which way the tide was turning. In closing arguments, Prosecutor Muldrew hit home with the motive in this circumstantial case. Craig wanted not just his brother's wife, but his brother's life, and he had killed to get it. Quote, "He is living in his dead brother's house, sleeping in his dead brother's bed, next to his dead brother's wife. He is taking his dead brother's children to school, and he's driving his dead brother's truck. He has become, for all practical purposes, Carrie Height." And there was no other motive, no robbery, no other bad business entanglements, just this horrific Shakespearean family tragedy. Craig Height's attorney did his best to downplay the family drama. Dal Bonds said the public perception that Craig somehow was trying to become his brother was completely distorted. He went on to say, quote, "The first thing I noticed about Craig when I first met him was what a genuine person he was and what a gentleman he was." He told the jury he was shocked by the lack of physical evidence. "There's no DNA, there were no fingerprints, there were no eyewitnesses, there are no confessions." And evidently, the jury had a hard time with this too. Their original vote was 8-4 split. One juror honed in on the lack of physical evidence. It bothered him. But during deliberations, he decided that the bruises on Craig's arm had, along with all the other circumstantial evidence, changed his mind. One juror didn't like the idea of putting a man away without even having the murder weapon. But the fact that Craig told so many lies and tried to get ahead of everything by telling the police about his missing gun, boots, and gas can is what finally convinced this juror. Those three items, if they had been found, would have been physical evidence. The jury realized that Craig knew this, got rid of everything, but was then dumb enough to point it out to the police himself. After several hours of deliberation, they voted to convict. Craig Height was sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 85 years, pretty much guaranteeing he will never be paroled. Robin had already moved on and had a few boyfriends during the trial and after. Craig Height was able to get an appeal heard by the Georgia Supreme Court because Robin had a new boyfriend bring a disassembled shotgun to a custom rifle builder who was a friend of the family. She said it belonged to Carrie and she wanted it reassembled so she could have it as a keepsake. He immediately turned it over to the prosecution. On appeal, Craig Height's defense attorney said they were never made aware of this gun, an assertion hotly contested by the prosecutor, who said he immediately notified defense counsel. Muldrew was able to prove this when on cross-examination, he said that Chris Height, the surviving brother, was with him when he took the shotgun to the sheriff. Chris thought it might help clear his brother's name. But the defense had declined to have it tested. The prosecution also declined, saying that five other shotguns were also brought in, and without the shell casings from the crime scene, there was no test that could prove that any of these guns were used in the murders. And the Georgia Supreme Court agreed, upholding the conviction in January of 2013. Incredibly, Craig's mother and brother still stood behind him. Chris said, quote, "It took a coward to walk in at 3 a.m. into a dark home and did what they did to our family. That's not Craig. Craig's not a murderer." When Linda Height was asked, "Can you be absolutely certain that it was not Craig?" She said, "Yes, I can. I know my child. I know the man he is. I know the heart he has. He does not have a cold-blooded heart. I can be certain Craig did not do this to our family." She went on to say, quote, "As a mother, I could not sacrifice the son that was killed and my husband that was killed to protect another son if I really thought that son did it." It is heartbreaking to read these quotes from a mother who lost almost everything. And from a brother who probably knew the truth deep down, but stood by his mother for her sake, not for his murderous brother Craig's. As I said in the opening, this crime seems to harken back to Cain and Abel, the Bible's morality tale of two brothers, one favored, the other jealous. Maybe as a deeply religious family, they are leaving Craig's final judgment to God. And Bible scripture tells us that God punishes Cain. Genesis chapter 4, verse 8. "The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground." Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. A great deal of my research on this case came from Savannah Now or the Savannah Morning News. There are also episodes of 48 Hours and Dateline with a lot of interesting interviews with players in this case. That Robin is a piece of work you should see for yourself. She was arrested after the trial for making harassing phone calls to her new boyfriend's ex. After the trial, she remarried and moved to Charleston, sharing custody of the children with Linda Height. She was arrested again for bouncing a child support check to her ex-mother-in-law. As far as I know, she remains a garbage person to this day, and the people of Springfield believe she got away with murder. I've mentioned it a couple of times now, but as a reminder, I'll be back at CrimeCon this year in New Orleans. I really hope some of you can make the trip. I'd love to meet you, and I'm looking forward to seeing familiar faces from last year. It's June 7th through the 9th, and if you're interested in going, please use my promo code to purchase your ticket. It's FriedCrime19. Several of your favorite podcasters will also be in the Big Easy, along with speakers, exhibits, and workshops, and everything CrimeCon has to offer. So again, to buy a ticket, don't forget to use my code, FriedCrime19. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher and most podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There, you can sign up to be a patron of the show or make a one-time donation and purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. We'd love to have you. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.